It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll pay a visit to Hayward, Wisconsin, where a Wisconsin nonprofit helps people with all types of disabilities get out on the water to go fishing.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of the state news with news guy Noah Ovshinsky.
The state of Wisconsin made national headlines this week when the Dane County District Attorney decided not to press charges against the police officer who shot and killed Tony Robinson.
In the world of politics, it looks like the state may see a rematch next year in the race for the U.S. Senate.
Also, the state's Joint Finance Committee has been busy this week as it continues to make decisions on key budget items.
We'll cover those stories and more right now with WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, Veronica, and as always, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. And we will begin with probably the biggest story this week out of Wisconsin, the decision in the shooting of Tony Robinson. What happened?
Yeah, so the DA in Dane County announced on Tuesday that he would not charge Officer Matt Kenny in the shooting death of 19-year-old Tony Robinson. His death sparked protests in the last few months, and to say that many, many people were waiting for this announcement would be an understatement.
The DA had announced on Sunday that he was going to give that announcement. It came on Tuesday. And what did he say?
So the DA spent part of the news conference sort of setting the table, more or less, for his decision. He laid out the facts as he knows them or those that were reported to him. And he discussed how he himself had a lot in common with Tony Robinson, a product of a biracial marriage, and that he, too, faced racial discrimination throughout his life. DA Ozan says what he called this tragic and unfortunate death was a result of the lawful use of deadly force.
And to come to that conclusion, Ozan had to look at the evidence. What did he come away with saying happened that day?
Right. So Robinson and Kenny's paths crossed when the officer went to investigate reports that Robinson was assaulting people and acting erratically. At an apartment on Madison's Near East Side, there was a confrontation. And according to Kenny, he shot Robinson because he feared that he would be knocked down the stairs and his gun taken away from him. Kenny says Robinson hit him when he went up to investigate.
And what was that response in the community in Wisconsin to this announcement?
So there was a rally on Tuesday immediately following the announcement, and then more protests yesterday, or rather Wednesday. The participants were, angry but peaceful. People who have been protesting Robinson's killing argue that, among other things, that Robinson's death was the result of racial disparities that exist in our justice system, as well as society at large.
And this does not look to be the end of the story. What do we know about what could happen next?
Right. So Tony Robinson's mother says she doesn't believe what the police say happened, in particular in the moments that were not captured by Kenny's squad car camera. And she says she plans to sue to find out that information. The Madison Police Department is also conducting its own internal investigation into whether or not Kenny followed procedures, followed the proper procedure. And the results of that investigation should be released in the next week or so.
Okay, so police department results released in only a week or so.
Yeah, it could be as much as 2 weeks, but as early as another week from now.
Okay, we'll be watching for that. And we'll move on talking about some state budget news. The Joint Finance Committee has been very busy. What happened this week?
Right, so the JFC met twice this week to go over Scott Walker's proposed budget. Yesterday, the committee voted to go along with the governor's plan to cut the amount of time somebody can receive W-2 benefits by 1 year. So right now, it's 5 years. They voted to cut that down to 4 years. W-2 is essentially what replaced traditional welfare here in Wisconsin.
And they did depart with the governor on one big change, didn't they?
Yeah. Yesterday, JFC leaders said they would actually reject governor's overhaul of long-term care programs in Wisconsin. This was somewhat a rare point of departure. Walker wanted to end what's called the IRIS program, which allows people with disabilities to hire family members to take care of them, and replace it with a system that utilizes private insurers. JFC leaders did say they would direct the Department of Health Services to draw up a more limited plan that could end up saving money in the future. But at the end of the day, they decided to part ways with the governor on this issue.
And there had been a lot of discussion about that IRIS program. So it's interesting to see how that's playing out so far.
Yeah, it came up a lot during the community meetings that happened around the state.
And what else did they do this week?
The JFC partially restored some of the cuts that were proposed for the ECB, which is an entity that, among other things, helps run WPR and WPT. While the cut was reduced roughly by half, Hudson Republican Dean Knutson noted WPR and WPT needed to increase funding and that state support should be more in line with other states. Democrats during the debate argued that public broadcasting would not be able to make up for those cuts through fundraising alone.
And when does the Joint Finance Committee meet again, and what are we expecting them to take up next?
They meet on Tuesday, I believe, and they are scheduled to take up education-related items, including the proposed cut to K-12, the Department of Corrections, and a few other odds and ends.
So a lot more big stuff on the table still to get through.
Yeah, several more weeks.
We're talking right now with WPR Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky. We're getting our state roundup of the top stories of the week, and we're going to wrap up with former Senator Russ Feingold wanting not to be former senator anymore in 2016.
People tell me all the time that our politics in Washington are broken and that multimillionaires, billionaires, and big corporations are calling all the shots. They especially say this about the U.S. Senate, and it's hard not to agree. But what are we going to do? Get rid of the Senate? Actually, no one I've listened to says we should throw in the towel and give up. And I don't think that either. Instead, let's fight together for change. That means helping to bring back to the U.S. Senate strong independence, bipartisanship, and honesty. So, today, I'm pleased to announce that I'm planning to run for the United States Senate in 2016.
Russ Feingold announcing via YouTube video that he is officially running for his old seat in the Senate. And as been noted in the last few days, this sets up a rematch between he and Ron Johnson. And as you might remember, Johnson rode the Tea Party wave in 2010 and beat Feingold, who was at the time completing his third term.
It's interesting. Another announcement via YouTube. Hillary Clinton made her announcement via YouTube, too. Seems to be certainly a new way that people are doing this.
Yeah, we're seeing it more and more.
And what was the response from Ron Johnson?
He attacked Feingold for building Washington into what he called, quote, a gigantic, debt-ridden, tax-eating, unresponsive, and freedom-squashing government. So, again, Ron Johnson seizing on, Feingold's original role in the Senate and sort of looking back as a way of looking forward with this campaign that's going to be unfolding here in the next months.
And judging from the news today, it sounds as though Senator Ron Johnson did see this coming, says he didn't expect it to happen so soon, though, the announcement.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think Feingold faces, a few challenges, also maybe a few advantages going into this election. It's too early to say for sure, but, money is going to be an issue in this campaign, and both candidates are going to have to raise a lot of money. Now, Feingold has disavowed super PACs and sort of so-called dark money in the past, and this is at a time when the cost of these campaigns have skyrocketed. So it'll be interesting to see how he navigates that. On the plus column for Feingold is the timing of this election. Unlike the last election in 2010, this one will take place in a presidential year when Democratic turnout is typically higher than it usually is. That will certainly help Feingold.
And how big a deal is this race shaping up to be nationally?
Big. There are going to be a lot of eyes looking at this race in Wisconsin. Democrats will need to pick up five more seats in order to retake control of the Senate. And this one, I think by most analysts, this one is considered a toss-up. So a lot of money and a lot of attention will be put on this campaign here in the next year.
Great. We'll be watching that one, too. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's Assistant News Director, helping us cover the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
An event in Hayward this weekend aims to help people with disabilities get out on the water and do some fishing.
The organization called the event Fishing Has No Boundaries, and it started in Hayward back in 1988. Every year since then, on the third weekend in May, the group welcomes people with mental and physical disabilities for a two-day event.
Today, Fishing Has No Boundaries has 27 chapters in 13 states that all hold their own fishing weekends.
Right now, we're joined by a chairperson for the Hayward chapter, Heidi Overman. Heidi, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Heidi, how did the Fishing Has No Boundaries organization get started?
Fishing Has No Boundaries started in Hayward, Wisconsin, about 28 years ago. It started with a local fishing guide that broke his leg and found how difficult it was to get into the fishing boat. So after that, he decided he would make an event for people with disabilities to help them get out on the water.
How has this grown from that humble beginning? How many people are you expecting this year compared with past years?
Well, that first year we had about 80 participants and about another 120 to 130 volunteers. This year, the Hayward chapter has 130 participants coming out, and we have about 200 to 250 volunteers coming out to help them out. But we also have expanded to having 26 events throughout the country.
Wow.
In 12 different states.
Well, sticking in Hayward for now, can you tell us about the range of people that show up for one of these events?
We have a wide range of people that come. They start off at the age of about 6 to mid-80s, and then it's a range of disabilities, people that are in wheelchairs. There's a missing, a missing limb if you might just have one hand, or certain different disabilities like that, the physical disabilities, and then also cognitive disabilities.
So what kind of special accommodations have you come up with over the years to make this possible?
Well, we've created quite a few different adaptive equipment. And, like, we have electric reels to make it easier to pull those fish in. And we have rod holders so that somebody who can't hold on to a rod for a long time can set it into a holder and continue to fish throughout the day.
Is this all equipment that is available, or do you ever have to, kind of come up with adaptations on your own? Because maybe this is not something that a lot of people are looking out for when it comes to fishing.
It's a combination of both. There's been some of our equipment has been stuff that's been made, and you can go and shop for it, like on any of the online retailers. And other things, it's things we just create at a whim. Some of it, just a little bit of Velcro and duct tape, and you get them going, and then we adapt it and kind of create something for the next year for them.
Do you get a lot of people who used to fish because of an injury or disability, couldn't fish for a long time, they're getting back into it? And if so, what kind of stories do you hear from them? How exciting is this?
Oh, it's a huge excitement to see people who love to fish. And then whether it was a car accident or some other type of disability, have been away from it for years. Some of them, maybe it was only a year, but if you love to fish and you miss it, it's going to seem like a lot longer. And then to get back out on that water and bring out family, because we'll have parents come out and then their kids come to help them out, and then to just do that fishing and enjoy it, it is wonderful.
What kind of things do they say? What does it mean to them to be able to be back out on the water fishing?
I'm trying to think of the best ones that I've heard. It's just amazing to see them out there. That doesn't matter what size fish they catch. I mean, you get them out there, and whether it's 2 inches or 2 feet long, it's the biggest fish in their mind. That's the biggest thing that I've seen. And then to be paid, I do this as a nonprofit, so it's all volunteer, and we are paid in hugs and smiles. And it's a huge family event, whether it's blood relatives or not. And then when it comes to people getting out on the water, they're excited because they get to catch those fish, and they're happy to see it. They plan their vacations around coming to the events.
We're talking with Heidi Overman of the group Fishing Has Now No Boundaries. She is in Hayward talking about adaptive fishing, making fishing accessible for people with disabilities. And Heidi, you mentioned as young as age 8 or so. Can you talk about the kids who get involved in this?
Well, the kids that get out there, they're excited because then they get to join in events into the sport of fishing, which maybe they've seen their older brothers and sisters do and just haven't been able to make it work for themselves. And we get it so that it becomes that family event, family fun that they can do together.
For most of these people, is this the one time of year that they can get out and fish, or do they bring some of the tools and techniques that they learn back home with them so that they can keep on fishing?
There's a lot of our participants that come out that this is the only time they get out a year to go fishing. It's the one time, so we make it big. We spend 2 days out fishing. They get a pontoon boat. They get a fishing guide. We get them out there. And that's about half of our participants that's how they fish. It's just that one time a year. And then other ones, they'll go to several Fishing Has No Boundaries events, or they'll take it back to them for the summer and maybe learn a new adaptation for fishing with their families.
Heidi, we've been focusing on the participants so far. Let's talk about the volunteers. Who is out there working on this event?
We have a lot of local area volunteers, and they come from a wide range of groups. I know for myself, I started with Fishing Has No Boundaries in the first event. I was 5 years old, and I came out with my Girl Scout troop. And over the years, I've just absolutely loved it and continued to do it. And, you know, and it has advanced for me to where I'm now the chairperson for the organization.
And what do the volunteers say they like best about being part of this?
They love to see the smiles and just to have that ability to help out somebody in something as simple as fishing, because to me it's just something I can just go jump in a boat and go fishing and not think about it. And the realization of not everybody can go fishing like that.
Now, if someone's listening and thinking, hey, I'm not in the Hayward area, we don't have one of these chapters of Fishing Has No Boundaries where I am, is it possible to start new ones, and how do you do that?
Yes, the national organization is always happy to help people in starting up a new chapter in their town or state, and all they'd have to do is call the national office, and that number is 715-634-3185, and ask for Kathy.
And you said that Fishing Has No Boundaries started in Hayward, and it's spread across the country. Can you give us a sense of where else it is besides Wisconsin?
Well, other than being in the Midwest of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Kansas, it's also out east in New York State, and then going towards Washington and Idaho, Colorado, and then, of course, like North Dakota as well.
Heidi, before we let you go, how is Hayward in general as a fishing area?
It is the perfect fishing location in the state of Wisconsin. Everybody comes up here to go fishing. We have world record muskies, and it's that fishing town. That's why it started here, and we're going to keep it going as long as possible.
Great. Heidi, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you so much.
That was Heidi Overman with Fishing Has No Boundaries. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
On Tuesday of this week, Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan announced that he would not file criminal charges against Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny. Kenny shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed black 19-year-old, in March of this year.
Throughout the week, Madison has seen vigils and demonstrations, and members of the community have spoken out about racial disparities in the criminal justice system.
Those dramatic disparities between blacks and whites in Dane County have been the subject of public conversation since a 2013 report came out showing that across almost every measurement of well-being, a large gap persists, and the state as a whole has similar disparities.
One of the organizations involved in that conversation has been the Urban League of Greater Madison, and this week they released a plan for addressing these issues moving forward. Here with us now is Reuben Anthony, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Madison. Reuben, welcome to Central Time. Hello, Reuben, are you with us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Perfect, now I've got you.
Okay.
Well, you have said that the decision in the Tony Robinson case is a defining moment for the community. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by that is that it is a decision that really requires us to pause. And, it's a tragedy. It causes people to grieve all over again, but it was a thorough decision. But it's just a tragedy when a young man's life is taken. You know, we have to talk about what can we do on the front end of things like this so that we can make sure that as we move forward as a community, that we don't have other Tony Robinsons. We have to make sure that we have collaboration with community groups to make sure that we address the disparities that have been stated over and over. It's the despair that young black men are facing in Madison and throughout the country that really has caused many to take note and just say, well, when will it stop? you know, the killing of African-American men, not just in Madison, but in this country, seems to be at an epidemic level. And we really need to figure out, you know, what we need to do. But I think that we have to do that on the front end, not on the back end. We have to figure out what we can do to help, you know, create access to opportunities for young men and young people in general in this community.
So when you say on the front end, you're talking about preventing problems before they happen, improving conditions now, and stopping the incident before it happens. Is that right?
That's right. So that means that we definitely have to start early. We have to work with the school system and make sure that young men and young women are progressing through the school system. We have to make sure that we continue to resource programs like the Schools of Hope and other programs to help students progress through school. At the same time, we have to create employment opportunities. A lot of young people are discouraged because they don't have jobs. We have to figure out, you know, how we can create access to opportunities for these young people. But even African-American adults are looking quite a bit for employment, and they're not always finding sustainable jobs. And so we really need to do a better job at helping with economic development and making sure that diversity and inclusion is a part of our strategy for economic development as we move forward. And yesterday we had a conference here in Madison where it focused on regional development and diversity. And I think that's a step in the right direction to start having community conversations about how we can include African-Americans and help African-Americans in this city also view Madison as the best place to live.
Now, earlier you used the word despair. You said there's despair in the African-American community. It sounds like particularly among African-American men. How does that despair translate itself into the issues that we're seeing right now?
Well, I'll tell you, Michael Johnson from the Boys and Girls Club held a youth summit a few weeks ago, and we met with a group of young men, about 50, and we asked the question, what are some of the things that concern you? And they pointed out that longevity concerns them. Maybe about a third of those individuals in the room said that they don't think that they're going to live beyond 21. That's a problem. To me, that's despair. When a young person feels like they don't have a bright future in a place that's being heralded as one of the best places to live in the country. And I don't know how prevalent this is across the races, but I do know that African-American young men and African-American men and women, you know, are struggling here based on the disparity statistics that we see. You know, we have to make sure that we work together to create access to opportunities for education, access to opportunities for housing, access to opportunities for jobs for all who live in this community.
We're talking right now with Reuben Anthony, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Madison, talking right now about how Madison, the Greater Madison area as a community, can move forward and prevent issues in the wake of the decision on Tony Robinson and the Tony Robinson shooting. And Reuben, you talked about this as a defining moment. So we've had a little bit of time to deal with this, not a lot, but how would you say the community has responded so far?
I think that a lot of different organizations have come together to talk about, you know, how we can keep this community whole. We know that this is a tragedy, you know, but we have to figure out, you know, how we sit down and how we move forward. So you have the United Way. You have the Boys and Girls Club, you have the NAACP, you have the Greek organizations for African Americans, you have this new Black Leadership Council, and you have policing organizations willing to sit down and talk about, you know, what do we need to do so that we know that these disparities get eradicated. And as long as if we sit down and are honest about the challenges that this community kind of imposes on people of color, and if we're willing to sit down and work through these things and figure out, you know, how we can get beyond these, I think we will make a step forward.
A strong line in the letter you sent recently, you encourage community members to listen instead of trying to be heard. Do you think that some people are doing too much talking and not enough listening?
No, I think that we have to listen. But I think that we have to recognize that there are multiple voices in the African-American community and the community abroad. You know, as we have these challenges, I don't think it's just an African, it's an African-American tragedy, but it's a tragedy also for the community of Madison as a whole. So as we try to resolve issues and disparities, I think that we have to have multiple voices around the table, and that would include, you know, African Americans and other people who really care about removing the disparities that African Americans face.
Do you think that the communities that you're talking about, the organizations, are ready to sit down and have this dialogue? Now we're talking about your organization, Young, Gifted, and Black, the Madison Police Department. Is there a safe space for those conversations to happen?
Well, I can't speak for all the organizations, but I know that there is a lot of talking going on right now among the nonprofit organizations and among government organizations and community groups. And so I think that's a nice step forward, and that's a start. You know, and we start there, and we agree to listen, and know that at the end of the day, we all want Madison to be a safe community for everyone, and the best place to live in this nation for everyone. And if we can kind of get together and figure out, you know, how we need to do that, so that African Americans don't feel threatened by those who are sort of protectors. And at the same time, the community police are sensitized culturally to, you know, how they can do less forceful policing when it comes to African Americans. I think we can make steps forward.
Now, you've joined the newly formed Black Leadership Council in Madison. What's the goal of that organization?
Well, the goal of that organization is to really show that there are multiple voices in the African-American community that are willing to put some skin in the game, roll up our sleeves, and go out and kind of help keep this community strong and keep this community safe. But the bottom line is that this group, you know, demonstrates that we have multiple voices and that we are willing to work to make this a better community.
And we're talking right now to Reuben Anthony, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Madison, about racial disparities in the criminal justice system in light of the Tony Robinson decision this week.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234, whether you're in Madison or another community around the state. How are things going where you are? Do you think the police and the criminal justice system treat your community fairly, regardless of race? What kind of changes would you like to see? And if you're African American, do you feel the sense of despair our guest mentioned? Do you see it in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Reuben Anthony, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Madison, talking about racial disparities in the criminal justice system in light of the Tony Robinson decision this week.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to improve relations between police departments and minority communities? What do you see going on in your community, wherever you are in the state? What needs to change, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Chris on the line in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling because I'm very concerned about the DA's decision and the lack of details of what actually happened that evening. As we know from Pastor Niemöller's quote, in World War II, when he said, first they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist, and then the socialists, and now they've come for me, and there's no one left to speak up. This is an issue that affects us all. And one of the things I've seen being gone from the States for the last 12 years and having moved back, there's not much discussion about the common good and the level of fear we all have from each other. You know, the fact that 7 shots could be fired into someone is astounding to me. And I'd like to know from Mr. Anthony where I can get involved, because we have got to bring people together to face our fears and to transcend them so we don't destroy each other.
Chris, thank you so much. Thank you for that call. And Reuben, what would you say to that? Someone who sees this, is disturbed, was looking for a conversation about the common good and wants to get involved.
Yeah, I would say listen out for when particularly like the faith community, pulls people together. I know Madison Urban Ministry with Everett Mitchell and others pulled together a peaceful march. That would have been an opportunity to participate. There'll be some prayer visuals just, you know, to bring the community closer together. And Bishop Rayford over the African American Council of Churches would welcome anyone to come into those prayers that, you know, kind of have a prayer for the community. And at the same time, there are other discussions that community discussions that will be going on with Nehemiah, and they have a lot of things where they're really trying to build partnerships across boundaries. And so I just say listen out, and if you can touch bases with us through the Urban League, that might also be an opportunity for us to kind of connect you when we hear that events are going on.
Chris, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that. And a question for you, Ruben. The Young, Gifted, and Black group that's focusing on criminal justice reform has gotten some criticism, in specific from Chief Koval, for being unreasonable in some of their demands, in specific the demand that the Madison Police Department have no interaction with, this is a quote, our own communities. What do you think of their demands and how they're approaching things?
Well, I'll tell you this. The Young, Gifted, and Black have the right to protest. Everyone has a right to protest. And they've exercised their civil disobedience. And at the last marches that they did, it was a peaceful march. And as long as we can keep the peace at the end of the day, people have a constitutional right to express what they want to express. Not just the Young, Gifted, and Black, but anybody that's disturbed by this situation have a right to express their civil disobedience. That's where I'm talking to say that there's multiple voices surrounding this situation, and different groups will take different approaches. For example, the Black Leadership Council took the approach of playing peacekeepers, you know, during this type during the last few days, and also observers, and so they chose to do it that way. Young, Gifted, and Black chooses to do it another way, but at the end of the day, I think they want the same thing as everybody else. They want this thing to stop. They don't want to continue to have African-American boys or anyone in this community killed at the hands of police or anybody else. So, I mean, you know, it's not time to really kind of pick groups against each other. It's a time for us to sit down and figure out, you know, how can we work together? And how can we be tolerant of different ways of expression?
And how do you begin to do that, to be tolerant of different means of expression?
I think what we have to do, you guys play a big role in that too. And you know, when someone does a peaceful demonstration, recognize that they did a peaceful demonstration. And I know there's a lot of hype about the Young, Gifted, and Black's demonstration, a lot of words, but at the end of the day, the other day, it was very peaceful. I think one of the things that really helped, you know, during that time is that the day before that, you had the faith community that came out and they demonstrated peacefully. I think that when we sit down and we recognize differences of opinion and allow that expression to occur, as long as at the end of the day that it's not damaging the community and businesses, we have to accept, you know, those things. People have different ways of making their points. But we all care about this community.
Now, nationally, the Urban League has produced a 10-point plan for reforming police practices. Can you tell us some of the biggest goals in that plan?
Well, the Urban League is definitely wanting to have an opportunity for people to express themselves, but here are the 10 points. The first point is that the National Urban League believes that there should be widespread use of body cameras and dashboard cameras. Second, the Urban League has broken window reform and implementation of their 21st century community policing policy. You have to get on the website to look for that. Third, review and revision of police use of deadly force policies, and that's being discussed right now in this city. Fourth, comprehensive retraining of all police officers. Five, comprehensive review and strengthening of police hiring standards. Six, appointment of special prosecutors to investigate police misconduct. Seven, mandatory uniform FBI reporting and audit of lethal force incidents involving all law enforcement. 8, creation and audit of national databases of citizen complaints against police. 9, revision of national police accreditation system for mandatory use by law enforcement to be eligible for federal funds. And then 10, national comprehensive anti-racial profiling laws. So those are the 10 points in the National Urban League Justice Plan for police accountability.
And do you see police departments in Wisconsin and Madison and Milwaukee and beyond being receptive to plans like these?
Yeah, I think that the police departments here in the greater Madison area are willing to sit down and talk. You have the United Way. They have a subcommittee that's really looking at the policing policies, and that's going to be chaired by Chief Sue Ressling and also Everett Mitchell from the University of Wisconsin. And that brings many voices around the table to begin to look at policing policies, not just in Madison, but in the greater Madison area.
Now, you said you want to create a vision, different voices coming together to create a vision for the future to make things better and a vehicle for change. Do you have any time frame in mind about measurable benchmarks when you'd like to start to see things changing?
No, I think we have to start planning for change right away. I think that we can't wait for another situation to occur where we have a tragedy like we had with Tony Robinson. We have to sit down now. This is not a spectator sport. You know, we can't sit, you know, as citizens and just continue to watch policies not work. We can't sit and just watch African-American men be gunned down by the cops. And at the same time, you know, we have to have better policing policy so that the cops are not, you know, under scrutiny and that they can do better community policing.
Take another caller. Now we've got Patrick on the line with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Mr. Rubin, glad to see you're on the show.
Thank you, sir.
I was calling because I see this in the other instances across the nation and even across the water. You got things going over in Israel where there's racism being inflicted on Ethiopian Jews over there. But it's the symptom, as the previous caller called and was talking about, the fear. That's the underlying energy that keeps this thing going. But with blacks, especially in this nation, is you have a group of people that have an identity crisis, and we have the media that keeps fueling deception that these young blacks can't identify with who they really are, because the media dictates to them what they should be.
All right, well, thank you for the call, Patrick. And I'm not sure exactly what you mean by identity crisis, but do you hear something in that, Ruben, about the way African-Americans are portrayed in the media right now?
I will tell you, the media doesn't do a good job of portraying African-American males. And then there's all these stereotypes that continue to proliferate throughout American society about African-Americans. And so people, you know, kind of have these fearful stereotypes about us. And I just think that we have to work through that, and we have to make sure that as a community, again, that we come together and that we have some honest discussions about what's not working with the policing policy in this country. And if people are willing to do that, I think we can take a step forward. The national backdrop is disturbing. It seems to be an epidemic that every time that you look around, whether it's in Baltimore, whether it's in Ferguson, an African-American is dying, whether it's at the hands of somebody who's concealed carrying it or whether it's at the hands of a police officer that might have used excessive force. So we have to do better in this country because African-Americans and other citizens deserve more.
Now, looking at Dane County in the wake of the Tony Robinson shooting, Dane County is about 6.5% of people who are African-American. So there are a lot of people who are not in that 6.5%. How do you feel that they have done in talking about issues of race and criminal justice? Just briefly.
Those folks that are not in the 6.5%, you mean the rest of the population?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that Madison is the type of community where citizens, you know, want a good community for all of us. But I think that we have some institutional bias built into certain organizations. Sometimes it's built into police organizations. Certainly it's built into employment structures where there is blockage or access entries where African Americans, Latinos, and others, you know, can't get, you know, equal opportunities for jobs. Same thing with promotions. Sometimes there's the glass ceiling built into infrastructures or different organizations that women, you know, can't go to managerial ranks. You know, we have some inherent biases that have grown into our city governments, county governments, state governments, and even in the private sector. But we have to do better as a society in addressing these disparities and biases that really affect women, minorities, and others.
And we leave it there. Reuben Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. Reuben Anthony, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Madison, talking about racial disparities in the criminal justice system in light of the Tony Robinson decision this week. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.